I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana. Thanks for joining us for the podcast today, brought to you by Blackfoot Communications.
Blackfoot Communications is excited to announce new voice services for small businesses. Paired with our internet services, business Wi-Fi, and technical support, your business can stay connected to your employees, customers, and communities around the clock. Sign up for services in less than 2 minutes at goblackfoot.com/morethanvoice. Connect to more with Blackfoot Communications.
You know, we always talk about controversial and consequential decisions for our country coming from our Supreme Court. I think every decision can be considered important and consequential, but it seems like some of the cases we're looking at now are very, very consequential. And it's not that they haven't come to us before. The power of the federal government versus the rights and powers of the states versus the rights and powers of the individual, industry. But that's basically it. It's federal government, it's states, it's individuals. Do we get clarity here? Well, that's the idea behind the courts, but you don't always get clarity. Major decisions for the U.S. Supreme Court, closely watched climate trial in Montana. We're going in-depth today with none other than, we call him the professor. He is a constitutional scholar and original voice of Montana, Rob Nadelson, today on Voices of Montana. Hey, thanks for being here. We are 2 decades strong, working on 3. We'll go back 2 decades and speak with a gentleman who got it going for us. But thank you for making us a part of your Montana mornings. We try to be that objective perspective here to issues, newsmakers, a little bit of fun. It was fun yesterday doing a little 406 in virtually. Today, it's a little heftier, I'm going to say. A little heftier lift. I'm just going to welcome our guest once again. He's a friend of the program, and as you know, original voice of Montana. It is senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence from the Independence Institute in Denver, Colorado, Rob Nadelson. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
It is a pleasure to be on once again with the great Tom Schultz, and it is particularly a pleasure to be talking to a Montana audience once again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you miss it, don't you?
I really do. Yeah. We get back to, for those people who don't know the background, for 24 years I was a professor of law at the University of Montana. I taught constitutional law, among other courses. And then when I took early retirement, the way I put it is I fled from academia and the craziness of Missoula. I realized that if I wanted to do consulting or constitutional work, I had to be in a place that was more centrally located. So we came down to Denver, where we had lived previously, and that's where the Independence Institute is located. But boy, I get homesick sometimes, and I get back to Montana every time I can, and that's helped by the fact that two of my daughters and two of my grandkids live in the Flathead area.
Yeah, and I'm happy that that you do get a chance to come back and visit and spend some time and every now and again, even in Billings. So I'm looking forward to that if that opportunity does arise.
I was back last month. I'll be back next month.
Good. I2I.org is where you'll find a lot of the writings there. He also writes an awful lot for the Epic Times, but you'll see him in the Washington Post, Washington Times, Wall Street Journal, American Spectre. It just goes on and on there. Professor, where do you want to start? I mean, there are some consequential decisions, whether some have, I think the waters of the U.S. is a big one, but there are some yet to be decided, too. What amongst all of these things have grabbed your attention?
Well, let's start with an overview. This morning, my wife says to me, you know, I was listening to ABC News, and they said that the Supreme Court has a 6-3 conservative majority. That's not right, is it? And I said, well, no, it's not right. It's kind of a routine part of the mainstream media narrative that there's a 6-3 conservative majority. There actually are no conservatives on the court in the sense that, let's say, Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, is a liberal activist. There's nobody like that on the conservative side. What we have is a centrist court that sometimes swings one way or the other. And so as we talk about the decisions, let's remember that. There are, as you say, Tom, a lot of really important decisions. A few already have been decided. A few are yet to be decided. And we'll pick up on the wetlands one, okay?
Yeah.
Should we do that?
Yep, Sackett versus EPA. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency. For many years, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers, who are the enforcement agencies for the Clean Water Act, have claimed jurisdiction over ponds and even dry lands, claiming that they're protecting the waters of the United States. And the Sackett's case is a good case in point. Mr. and Mrs. Sackett owned land in Idaho. It was completely dry, and they wanted to change the configuration of the land. They wanted to do some dredging. And the Environmental Protection Agency threatened them with fines of $45,000 a day if they did that. Well, why in the world would they have jurisdiction over dry land under the Clean Water Act? Well, the Environmental Protection Agency says, well, you don't actually have any water, but across the road from you, there's a 30-foot-wide street. Across the road, there's a water ditch. And that water ditch flows into a non-navigable stream. And that non-navigable stream flows into Priest Lake. And we have declared Priest Lake, even though it is wholly within the boundaries of Idaho, to be navigable. And so the Sacketts decided to fight this, and good thing they did. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously on May 25 that the Environmental Protection Agency had exceeded its authority by trying to exercise jurisdiction over the Sacketts. The court split 5-4 on whether the Environmental Protection Agency could manage a wetland. The majority, led by Justice Alito, said that a wetland, a swamp or whatever, can be controlled by the EPA only when the surface waters of that wetland run seamlessly into the surface waters of a lake or stream. The minority said, well, we think that if they're somewhat close, that that's good enough. But the majority said that the wetland actually has to be contiguous to a lake or a stream. So a big victory for property owners there. The only disadvantage is that the court did not do what I would argue they should do, is to say that insofar as the EPA is trying to exercise jurisdiction over non-navigable waters, they're violating the Constitution. They're just going beyond the power that the Commerce Clause gives them. And I think Justice Thomas agrees with that, because he wrote a decision in which he cited a work I had written on, he cited it twice, arguing that the Commerce Clause really is being extended beyond its rightful force here.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk about that as well. That's almost an aside, because it's a or show in itself, the legal meaning of commerce in the Commerce Clause. When I was catching up to date on some of this, I looked at that, and I was joking with you earlier that whenever I'm researching and reading your stuff, I have to read more and more and more of it, because it there's just all this background that adds up there. I think the thing that you noted there is that this court had an opportunity probably to clarify, and then they failed to clarify this, and so we'll see this perhaps clarified, or is this enough? I don't know, so that
well,
they have satisfied.
They clarify the jurisdiction over wetlands, unfortunately, and when we get to another case, we'll see they're unwilling to take on Congress on the limits of the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
The Commerce Clause is a provision in the Constitution which says the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. And so the article you're referring to, I actually researched. I was on sabbatical from the University of Montana. I was at Oxford University researching in their library, because I wanted to know what people in the founding generation meant by commerce. And all the details are too much to go in today, but let's just say that control over wetlands, non-navigable wetlands, is not part of commerce. Control over truly navigable waters, like the Missouri River, that is part of commerce. And but as unfortunately, to mix metaphors here, the Supreme Court has allowed Congress to flow way over the boundaries that the Commerce Clause actually defines. Issues of wetlands, issues of real estate are really supposed to be state issues under our constitutional system.
And why is that so hard to argue or to clarify?
I can't get into the heads of the justices, but yeah. I think they're a little reluctant to take on Congress. And this shows in a decision which came out just last Thursday, Brekeen versus Holland, which also dealt with a Commerce Clause. Again, remember the wording, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. And the question in this Brekeen case was, could Congress, in the exercise of its commerce power, adopt a detailed statute specifying when and how homeless Indian children could be placed in foster homes and adoptive care? Obviously, to any reasonable person, that's not commerce in the sense of trade. It's not even economic. It's about the welfare of children. And yet Congress claimed that its power to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes gave it that authority. And by a 7-2 majority, believe it or not, the Supreme Court agreed with Congress. Really, I've written on this recently. You can find my article in the Epoch Times appeared yesterday.
Yep.
The majority opinion and Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinions are just a mess. That means they're chaotic, confused, and contradictory. They say one thing, one part of the opinion, and another thing in another part of the opinion. And I think that is evidence that the court knows at some level that Congress is exceeding its rightful powers, but they're not willing to take on Congress. Justice Alito dissented, which I consider a good sign because he hasn't dissented in cases like this before. And Justice Thomas also dissented. And once again, I was proud that he relied three times on an article I wrote on the Indian Commerce Clause at the University of Montana.
Yeah, and in that article, and I'll note it here again, as you noted, came out in the Epoch Times. It's entitled "The Supreme Court's Chaotic Commerce Clause Decision" with Rob Nadelson, our guest here, senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence from the Independent Institute in Denver, Colorado. You noted, I liked how you said there's no more polite way to describe it. It's a mess. But also the Gorsuch concurrence. You were very disappointed in that.
Yeah, you know, Justice Gorsuch is a Westerner. He's from Colorado. And he is fairly knowledgeable about Indian affairs, but I think his sympathy for the tribes misled him in this case. And if you read his opinion carefully, and by the way, I think he's an outstanding jurist, 99.9% of the time. This was really not his best work, to put it mildly. If you read the opinion, you can see him contradicting himself. Let me just give you one quick example. I don't want to get too wonky. During the administration of George Washington, the federal government exercised broad powers over the Indians. But they did so because there were treaties with the Indians, because Indians lived in federal territories, because Indians were not citizens and they had power over foreign affairs, and then they also had power to regulate interstate commerce. Well, Indians are now American citizens. A treaty was not involved with the Indian Child Welfare Act. We're not talking about Indians that live in federal territories. And so Congress's only possible power over them is the Indian Commerce Clause. And yet what Justice Gorsuch does is he takes what the Washington administration did under this big collection of powers, much of which don't apply anymore today, and just shoehorned them all into the Interstate Commerce Clause. I mean, the Indian Commerce Clause. That is just bad jurisdictional, jurisprudence. He also, the first third of his opinion is just a recital of all the harms that have been done to Indians. I mean, I'm sympathetic to that. Actually, I've got some Indian blood myself, but shame or injustices like that, that's not good constitutional argument. That's not what he should have been doing. In fact, it's very simple. Congress exceeded its power. Congress got into an area that belongs to the states, and the court just should have said so.
And that is what I think a lot of people are looking for, a bottom line. You know, where can you draw a line in the sand as to where the authorities exist on one side and where they exist on the other? I've got to take a break. There's there were some silver linings in that case, as you noted. And again, we're talking about what we know as the Indian Child Welfare Act and Hallin versus Brackeen. We'll conclude with those silver linings there because those are interesting to note, too. And there's more to address as we're going to talk about the rights of the individual versus the state when it comes to tax foreclosures. That's another important case, Tyler versus Hennepin County. We're back with more Professor Rob Nadelson today on Voices of Montana.
Does your home qualify for a $70 discount on your internet bill? Blackfoot Communications is proud to partner with the FCC to help ensure that households can afford the broadband necessary for work, school, healthcare, and more. For more information on this federal program and to see if your household qualifies for a discount on your internet service, visit goblackfoot.com/ACP. Connect to more with Blackfoot Communications.
We're back live here. Tom Schultz and Voices of Montana from Montana for Montana with Rob Nadelson, the original voice of Montana and a constitutional scholar. As we talk about some of these cases from the Supreme Court, another a big one in Montana as well, where the state just wrapped up their side of the argument, held versus Montana. That's the climate change argument. We'll get to that here in a little bit. We will conclude on the Brackeen and Howland decision here. We talk about some silver linings in just a bit. But let's take a call. Rob, thanks again for being here. You're familiar with Skip in Hamilton, listening on Hamilton's KLYQ. And good morning, Skip. You're on with the professor.
How are you doing, Skip?
Oh, thank you, Tom. And it's nice to hear your voice there on our local station over here in Hamilton. Before you're off, would you please tell us about a possible book that you might be writing about Montana history? And by the way, please explain to us what the case was that you got a citation from the United States Supreme Court recently. We'd love to hear about that. I wanted to say that we have two retiring Supreme Court justices in the state of Montana, and what our options are to fill those and hopefully educate the people of the state that we need to fill those with conservative thinking judges. And I thought I'd throw that one at you to see if you thought the same, what we can do with our existing Supreme Court while we have this opportunity in the next session.
Yeah, that's interesting. Skip, I'm just going to throw that. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. Rob, in general as well, you know, maybe talk about the importance of Supreme Court elections. Is there a process that possibly needs, I mean, we talk about transparency there. They're supposedly nonpartisan. I don't know. In general, Montana is going to have an opportunity, though, with two new Supreme Court justices upcoming here in the next session.
The Montana Supreme Court's been a hard case. Right. I've studied state Supreme Courts all over the country, as well as did my former colleague, Jeff Rents at the University of Montana. We both reached similar conclusions, and that is the Montana Supreme Court is an outlier. It's not just that it's liberal. There are lots of courts that are liberal. It's that the court overrules its own precedents at an incredible rate. The quality of the jurisprudence, the quality of the writing on the court, the quality of the decisions has not been good. And generally speaking, the electorate often isn't keyed into these problems. They're influenced by last-minute advertising from the trial lawyers who like to, you know, to get their people on the court. All I could say to Montanans at this point is pay attention. You know, be absolutely certain before you cast your ballot what the different candidates stand for. Because, again, all too often we've seen, you know, ultra-left judges being elected by large majorities in conservative parts of Montana, which tells me that people are not paying attention. The silver linings, Skip's question is to cases I've been cited in by Supreme Court justices. There actually have been 11. They began in 2013 when the Independence Institute did something that, unfortunately, our liberal University of Montana never did, which was to promote my work. And so I've been cited by the late Justice Scalia, by Chief Justice Roberts, by Justice Alito, and by Justice Thomas multiple times. 11 cases, 39 times. Three of those cases were this term, all by Justice Thomas, a total of 11 separate citations. Six of the citations occurred in a case which we should discuss called Health and Hospital Corporation Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County versus Tlaibski, and that deals with the fact that Congress is spending so much money on anything and everything and how the court responded to that.
And maybe we'll have time to – well, I've got that on the list here, or we have it on the list, so – I do want to get to that. Let's finish up with the silver linings from this Howland case.
Well, the, in the Brackeen versus Holland case, which for those just tuning in, is a case in which the court, in a very convoluted and contradictory opinion, upheld a law under the commerce power, which clearly exceeded the commerce power. One silver lining is the power of Justice Thomas's dissent in that case. And another silver lining is the fact that Justice Alito, for the first time, decided, as far as I can see, for the first time, decided that Congress had exceeded its power, at least for the first time in what's not called a commandeering case. And then finally, when you've got an opinion as chaotic as the opinion in Brackeen versus Holland was, what happens in the ensuing years is the court often doesn't follow it. They punch holes in it. They construe it narrowly. They find in exceptions, and eventually they overrule it. You know, this happened belatedly to Roe versus Wade. If it had been abortion, it probably would have been overturned, 3 weeks after it was decided.
Yeah.
But I think it will eventually happen with Brackeen versus Holland because the case is just not good constitutional law.
Yeah. Do these justices, do they contact you if they're going to cite your work?
No, yeah. They do not. And thank goodness they do not. they're not really, I don't think they're really supposed to do that.
Okay.
What they do is look at the work that's in the legal databases. Sometimes they look on their own initiative, and sometimes a party will cite my article in one of their briefs, and then the justice will pick it up from that.
Yeah. It's got to be exciting, though. It
is exciting, yeah. And I'll say it's also exciting because it almost never happens to somebody from a place like the University of Montana. It usually happens to somebody from Harvard, you know. Yeah. However, let me also mention, I mentioned Jeff Rentz was a minute ago. Mm-hmm. Jeff Rentz was at the University of Montana at the same time I was, and Justice Thomas also cited him in the spending clause case, Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County versus Tlaibski. Now, I believe the two of us, I mean, obviously I was cited back in 2013, but I believe the two of us are the only University of Montana law faculty members to ever been cited by Supreme Court justices, at least in modern times.
Yeah.
I don't know if you go back 50 years.
Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County versus Tlaibski. Talk about why, you think that's an important case.
The 1930s, the New Deal Supreme Court converted a limit on Congress's spending power into an authorization to spend anything Congress wanted to for the general welfare. One reason why we never balance our budget and why we have this huge debt. Anyway, the spending power came up in this Tlaibski case where a man had been in a nursing home. The nursing home was accepting federal funds, and the man's family sued, claiming that the nursing home had violated some rules in the or conditions of the federal grants. In other words, conditions on receiving federal funds. Well, the majority of the court held, and this is an example where this court is not conservative. It's quite a liberal decision. It decided that all these conditions that were agreed to between the nursing home and the federal government had the force of law and that enabled any patient to sue under them. Justice Thomas once again wrote a dissent in which he pointed out that the spending power was never designed to be that broad, and that's where he cited another one of my articles, and he also cited Professor Rentz's article. And then he went on to say, look, the contract agreement between the federal government and the nursing home is really not a constitutional law. Okay, it's just a contract, and so you can't really say that under federal statutes somebody has the right to enforce those conditions as a matter of law.
Professor Rob Nadelson,
I've
got to take a break. I apologize for interrupting at this point, but a good point to come on back and get more into this case with the professor here in just a minute on Voices of Montana.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
Does your home qualify for a $70 discount on your internet bill? Blackfoot Communications is proud to partner with the FCC to help ensure that households can afford the broadband necessary for work, school, healthcare, and more. For more information on this federal program and to see if your household qualifies for a discount on your internet service, visit goblackfoot.com/ACP. Connect to more with Blackfoot Communications.
He's the author of Lies Law Professors Tell. I like that title. Rob Nadelson is with us here, senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence from the Independence Institute, cited, as you noted, several times by the state Supreme, by the U.S. Supreme Court for his research in constitutional law. It's always a pleasure. It's always, I think, an honor here as well. Chris, stand by in Columbia Falls. We'll get to your question here in just a little bit. Tomorrow, we're going to have Les Kodlik on, and he's a member, a distinguished member of the VFW Post 2252. This is Glacier Park Veterans of Foreign Wars. And we'll talk about this wall that heals. It arrived in Kalispell yesterday. They're taking today because it's a big, big display to put it together. And then it'll be on display free of charge 24/7 from June 22nd through the 25th at Glacier High School, the soccer facility there, too. So we're talking about that tomorrow, too. But just a note on that for folks in the Kalispell area or anywhere across Montana, if you make the trip there this week, and make sure you catch that. Rob, thanks again for being here. I appreciate that. Just a note to finish up. Chris, we'll get to your call here in just a little bit. One more on the Tlaibski case, Health and Hospital Court. Go ahead.
For those who just tuned in, the Tlaibski case is a case Supreme Court just issued, deals with the overgrown spending power of the federal government, and Justice Thomas, in his dissent, has a review of the spending power and some of the constitutional problems that have accompanied the idea that Congress can spend anything it wants on anything it chooses. So I do recommend that Tlaibski dissent to anybody interested in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's all I have to say on the case.
Yeah, and I'm going to read that when I get time, too, because spending has been, it's something we talk about an awful lot. Let's go to Chris listening in Columbia Falls on KOFI's 1180 AM. They're also 104.3 FM, a big stick up there in the Flathead. Chris, good to have you on.
Thank you. Rob, there is one insidious thing going on here that really bothers me. And when I look back, I think of Learned Hand. He wrote a piece about liberty, you know, and he says that if it dies in the hearts of men and women in the country, he says, then the Constitution just won't help you. So the question basically is about morals and ethics. There is a Supreme Court Ethics Oversight Committee now, which I wasn't aware of, but I'm looking into it, and it kind of frightens me. You said earlier that no one asks you for your opinion, but they're asking the opinions of these committees. There's a number of different committees that they ask for review and assist the Supreme Court. Now, I'm so naive, I guess. I get 83 years old, so I'm naive to think that I always thought the Supreme Court was a body in the sense that it follows the Constitution the way it's written and the words mean. So they review it with other historical cases to decide for the men and women of this country, you know, what these values are. So if you don't have any morals, if this country is changing in a way that it has no morals, then it has no ethics. And that's a scary outcome. It's just too bad that we have to go down this road. So I'm thinking that Learned Hand was right, you know, and people are losing their liberties because they're relying on other people to decide their ethics, or they're giving their persuasion to the Supreme Court people who's supposed to decide.
Thanks, Chris.
The words.
Go ahead, Rob.
What Jefferson said.
Go ahead, Rob, in discussion there. I think that's a good discussion point. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, for those people who don't know, Learned Hand was a federal appeals court judge, and he's widely considered by legal scholars as probably the greatest appeals court judge who never sat on the Supreme Court. So Chris is citing a good source. Yes, the Supreme Court, Supreme Court is bound by ethics. There are two different kinds of ethics. One kind of ethics is, you know, you don't steal stuff and you don't go behind people's back to accept bribes or whatever. The other kind of ethics, though, was touched upon by Chris, and that is the need to apply the Constitution and the laws as they have been adopted. When the founders created our Constitution, they were people who, as we all know, didn't think much of the British king, and they didn't think much of the British Parliament, but they profoundly respected the British courts. They respected the high standards, high ethical standards, the high levels of independence, and the high levels of judicial competence that the courts demonstrated at that time. And they expected the federal courts, and in particular the Supreme Court, to adopt that same high level of competence and ethical probity. But what happened during the 20th century was that the court became very political. There were always some politics involved, but I mean, becoming very political really began during the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. And you see decisions being made, like Brekeen versus Holland, that make no sense as a matter of constitutional law, but are being made, I think, because of some fear or outside influence or concern about matters that really should have been irrelevant. I think the Obamacare decision, by the way, Obamacare decisions fit in the same category. So ethics obviously are a bedrock for a good citizenry. They're also a good bedrock for a fine judiciary.
Would you concur with Chris that there is an ethical decline in jurisprudence?
Yeah, I think that's inherent in what I just said. I think that, look, if you look at the court up in the 1920s and early 1930s, you notice a phenomenon we never see today. You see liberals like Louis Brandeis or Cardozo being appointed by Republicans. You see conservatives like James McReynolds being appointed to the court by liberals like Woodrow Wilson. And that was as a result of a recognition that these guys are all going to enforce the Constitution as it has historically been understood and as it's written. And understandably, there are always areas of doubt, okay? But the fundamental rule was originalism. That is the idea that you supply the supreme law of the land, you apply the Constitution as it was written and as it was understood when it was ratified. That all changed dramatically beginning in the middle years of the 20th century, late 1930s, 1940s, and on. And so now the appointments to the courts are highly political. If somebody is appointed to the court that a pressure group doesn't agree with, then they scream, they raise a big scream. That is a product of, I think, partly the breakdown of judicial integrity and of judicial ethics beginning in the 20th century and continuing into the 21st. Now, again, I'm not saying these guys are corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they're not personally honest or that they're going behind people's back. What I am saying is that they're not applying the standards of judicial probity that the founders expected them to apply based upon the standards that existed in the English judicial system at the time the Constitution was written.
Is there a process for restoration of that?
The primary process, and we've discussed it before on your show, is constitutional amendment, is adopting a constitutional amendment to correct the court. Mm-hmm. It's something that's been done three times, and each time the court becomes chastened, and they tend to respect that amendment sometimes more than they respect the original Constitution. But a constitutional amendment would require, because Congress won't propose one, would require a convention of the states. And that, of course, is a whole new topic. But it's really ultimately the only permanent solution. You know, and you can see that even when Roe versus Wade was overruled. The overruling of Roe versus Wade was considered a victory. But what did it take? It took 50 years of political effort, including what many activists viewed as betrayals, in the course of time. And when it was finally overruled, it was overruled 5-4. By any objective jurisprudential measure, Roe versus Wade is one of the worst decisions ever adopted. And yet it took 50 years to get a 5-4 decision to reverse it. You pass a constitutional amendment reversing a decision, it can be done in a year or two.
Do you think, and with that, I got a ton of questions after that. I'm just going to say ethical decline without putting a whole lot of prejudice into that. Do you see these things as being sometimes permanent or oftentimes, as in politics, it's a pendulum?
Well, when the court becomes political, yes, it moves with politics like a pendulum. I mean, there was a joke by a progressive from the 20th century that the court ratifies the election returns or something to that effect. That's a cynical view based upon the idea that the court is or even should be a political institution. Now, again, we can disagree around the edges. I mean, if you're a political conservative like me and a traditional liberal like my former colleague Jeff Rentz, who I mentioned, you know, we can disagree about issues around the edges. But when the court does what it did in the New Deal era and just totally discards major limitations on Congress and on the federal government and does things like approve the execution in secret of an American citizen without trial by jury or the incarceration of tens of thousands of American citizens of Japanese ancestry, that kind of abdication by the court is a real ethical breakdown. And while it's not quite as bad as it was in the 1930s and 1940s, the court has never really recovered, in my view, the level of jurisprudential quality that it was expected by the founders to have. Having said that, Tom, we probably should say something about the decisions, the big ones that are coming up that have not yet been decided.
Great. We'll do that after the break. Rob Nadelson is with us here, and we're back with more to conclude on Voices of Montana in just a bit.
Blackfoot Communications is excited to announce new voice services for small businesses. Paired with our internet services, business Wi-Fi, and technical support, your business can stay connected to your employees, customers, and communities around the clock. Sign up for services in less than 2 minutes at goblackfoot.com/morethanvoice. Connect to more with Blackfoot Communications.
Always a good read. You'll find articles in the Epoch Times, Washington Post, Washington Times, The Economist, American Spectator, I2I. It's I, the number 2, and then the letter I.org for the senior fellow, for the Independence Institute, where Rob Nadelson is senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence. Rob, again, thanks for your time here. Lightning round. We're looking at First Amendment stuff. We're looking at apportionment and looking at student loans in upcoming Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, let's go. Number one, there are two cases dealing with the constitutionality and legality of universities as part of their so-called affirmative action programs, discriminating against Caucasians and discriminating against Asians. Supreme Court will determine whether that is legal and constitutional. Secondly, Biden versus Nebraska. Does the President of the United States have the unilateral power to forgive student loan debt and add potentially billions, trillions of dollars to the national debt with a stroke of a pen? Next one, Moore versus Harper. This determines whether the apportionment of legislative districts for members of Congress in a state, is that the responsibility just of the legislature, as the Constitution says, or can the governor and the courts second guess what the legislature has done in apportioning congressional districts? And then finally, one that a lot of eyes are on, 303 Creative against Alanis. Everybody remembers the cake maker who was persecuted because he was a conservative Christian and didn't want to provide cakes for same-sex weddings. This is a similar case also coming out of the rather authoritarian authorities in Colorado. It involves a web designer. She's a Christian. She doesn't want to design websites for same-sex marriage websites, and she argues that that she has a right under the free speech clause, not the religion clause, but under the free speech clause, to design the sites as she wishes. So those are the big cases coming up.
Have you followed at all this court case involving climate change in Montana, Held versus Montana?
Oh, I think it's a joke. I mean, it should not be before the courts. The plaintiffs have no standing. Some of the plaintiffs are as young as 5 years old. They not only have no standing, they have no understanding. And the case raises an interesting question. When climate change turns out, if it does turn out, to be beneficial, as many people believe it that global warming would, beneficial for crops, beneficial for commerce, beneficial for plants, are those folks who bring the case going to be liable for any damages?
That's we don't have a ton of time, obviously, and but a lot of people have felt that that this case did not belong in court. In fact, a lot of courts rejected this case.
No, yeah. It doesn't belong in court, and the Montana environmental right was never designed to belong in court. You read the ratification era record of 1972; it will tell you that the environmental right was designed to be essentially a recommendation or direction to the state legislature. Gotcha. It was never designed to be anything that the courts adjudicate at all.
Rob, thank you so much. We've got so much more to talk about.
Thank you.
Yeah, be well. We'll see you in a little while, I hope.
You've been listening to Voices of Montana. Comments and opinions heard are those of the host or callers and not necessarily those of this station, sponsors, or Northern News Network. Join us Monday through Friday at 9:06 for Voices of Montana.